The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. We will all remember where we were on the night John Stones thighed one in at Old Trafford in the semi-final of the Carabao Cup. City beat United on a day where Colin Bell was remembered to set up a final with Spurs. Jose's pragmatic men see off Brentford with the help of an accurate offside decision and the speed and ruthlessness of Heung-min Son. It feels like years ago, but we'll discuss the tears of Ralf Hasenhüttl as Liverpool's woeful form leaves them top of the Premier League. Is it okay to tell your mates to lump on if you're going to Madrid? Is it okay to take a mini break in Dubai when the rest of us are locked up? And is it okay to ask how Big Sam would have set up to defend the seat of US government? Because, frankly, all your questions were about that. We'll do all that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. Now, on the discussion last week of the ultimate lineup that was Barry, John Bruin and Barney Ronne, Ed got in touch to say incredible scenes. After someone wrote in on Monday saying that Barry, Barney and Bruin was the dream pod lineup, I had to think about what mine would be. And this was it. Four seasons in, Max, and you finally know your best team. And here it is. Jonathan Liu, hello.
Hello.
Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning. I think I'm right in saying this is the third time, only the third time we've ever had this lineup. And each time it's been the first one of a lockdown.
Yeah. Well, the feeling is that when people are at their lowest, it's these three cheery souls that will eke out a tiny bit of positivity. Hey, Barry.
Hello, Max and everyone else.
Ben says, looking forward to the Thursday pod. I can finally learn the result of the United City League Cup semi-final. I got distracted by the attempted coup in my country and missed the match. What did I miss? Well, Ben, it finished Manchester United 0, Manchester City 2. City reaching their fourth League Cup final in a row. United's fourth semi-final defeat in a row. And Barry, just another very good performance from Manchester City.
Yeah, they seem to be well and truly back to the best. I don't think Manchester United played particularly badly, but they still were pretty comprehensively beaten at home by their City rivals, and can't really have any complaints. It was a very, very impressive performance from City.
The pace they break at, Johnny Liu, is so good, isn't it? Like, for example, that Kevin De Bruyne strike that hit the post, it's a real shame it didn't go in. But the speed of it is, when City are on it, it feels better than anyone else in the league.
Yeah, I mean, the counter-attacking was, I mean, obviously we expected United to play on the break, but in fact it was City who counter-attacked with so much more purpose and decisiveness, and I think Foden actually adds a huge amount to their counter-attacking game, because of his energy and the way he kind of, you know, you could see him sort of head down, really sprinting to get into position, in the way that you kind of do when you're that age, you know, you just like, you know, you just really want to get involved and you sort of run like a child as fast as you can. I thought City looked pretty close to what you know Guardiola has called the City of 2 years ago. They were pretty good against a poor Chelsea. Here they were pretty good against a decent United, I think, although you know they lacked a little bit in attack, and I don't know whether, you know, people talk about City looking ominous as at the turn of the year as we kind of head into the second half of the season, and I think that there's a little bit to that having overcome their little wobble early in the season, they are beginning to motor a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the West Brom game was only December the 15th, so that's less than a month ago. And I sort of remember being involved in various discussions around that game of, is this actually the worst side Guardiola's ever had? I mean, clearly that's a very high bar. It's a low bar for badness, it's a high bar for goodness.
Right. And it's your first album, Wilson, isn't it?
I don't know what that means.
You've really rattled him there.
I have, yeah. I apologise to everyone using a music analogy. It seemed quite a simple one. Who knew? Who knew that his Achilles heel was... It was so easy. It was just a nick on the Achilles heel. And we finally finished Wilson. I suspect Ben doesn't think this is the best lineup anymore. Oh, yeah, no, it was Ed,
I knew music was Wilson's Achilles heel, but I at least thought he knew what an album was.
Anyway, Wilson. It was Ed, by the way, who said this was the best lineup. Anyway, Wilson, you were saying a month ago, was it the worst Pep team ever?
Anyway, I think there was a reasonable case to say that. They didn't, you know, they seemed uncertain at the back. They lacked fluency going forward. And the last two performances have been exceptional again. And okay, on Sunday was a little bit of a caveat of, you know, how good is that Chelsea really? But I thought United, as Barry said, I thought they actually played pretty well last night. And yet there was a 10-minute, or maybe 15-minute patch of the first half and a 15 or 20-minute patch of the second half when City could have scored, you know, three or four goals. And City could easily have won that game sort of 5-0 and it wouldn't have been unrepresentative. 2-0 was probably fairer, but they look solid and they've got that verve back.
A tactical question, Wilson, about playing Foden on the left and Sterling on the right, and this idea of, you know, that seems very sort of late 80s to have wingers playing on, in my mind, in my dinosaur mind, is where they should be playing.
Yeah, and I think maybe we're just seeing that fullbacks are no longer used to dealing with that. I mean, what it does give you is it does stretch the pitch. And, you know, if you look back at sort of classic sort of, you know, the classic Dutch teams of the early 70s, who were sort of the seed for all of the sort of Barcelona Guardiola football, they would always have proper wingers to keep the pitch wide up front. I guess doing that without an orthodox centre-forward maybe is a little bit unusual, but it does just create flow, and it means you can then get people like De Bruyne breaking from midfield. And you know, the last two games, they've looked really good doing that. So,
you mentioned no orthodox centre-forwards. Aguero, Pep doesn't think he's fully fit yet. Do you think this is, Barry, the end of Aguero?
No. Maybe stretching it, but I'd like, be very reluctant to write him off. I think it's been done before, and anyone who has done it in the past has been made to look pretty foolish. But playing the false nine, it clearly gives the United centre-backs plenty to think about that they would rather not have to think about, I think, saying the word think far too often there. But it would be very foolish to say that there's no place for Aguero in that team.
How does a false nine work, Johnny? Like presumably you're still going to be in the positions where a centre-forward is. Is it just because it's not a recognised centre-forward that it confuses defenders, or they do drop deeper, or what?
Well, I mean, I think the idea of the false nine, you know, is that you force the defence to go and mark to go out of their comfortable position. So the striker sort of drops deep into, I guess, a slightly deeper role, and the defender then has the dilemma of whether to go and follow them or whether to, just to let them play and give them space. And I think, you know, City do that very well on lots of occasions. They sort of cluster four or five players in that sort of dangerous area about 30 or 40 yards out, and they start little, you know, little combinations, little triangles, and because they're so good at creating numbers in that area, it's really quite hard to counter, and it does pose a lot of problems for a defence. I guess, you know, the issue is then once you get the ball into the dangerous area, you know, who gets on the end of that chance. But does the tactic expert have a kind of slightly different interpretation of that? But I think that's kind of how false nine works.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's
I thought he was referring to me.
I thought he was referring to me as well. Yeah. Anyway, Wilson, how presumptuous, Jonathan.
Well, he looked at me. I mean, admittedly, on Zoom.
Carry on.
On Zoom.
I think the first false nine we really became aware of in England, not that anybody used the term, was Nando Hiddekuti in 53 when Hungary beat England 6-3 at Wembley. And Harry Johnston, who was the England and Blackpool centre-half, there's a really good bit. I think it's actually in his autobiography. I don't think it's a post-match quote. And he talks about that game and just sort of this sense of of panic that he had. He just didn't know what to do because, you know, a classic number nine played up against him, and people put crosses in and he battled in the air for it, and that was all he did. And suddenly there's a centre-forward who's not standing where he's meant to be. He's sort of dropping off 15, 20 yards. And Johnston was saying, well, if I go and follow him, I'm leaving a huge gap between the fullbacks. But if I stay where I am, he's just turning and he's creating the play. So, yeah, the idea of a false nine is that he you know, he drops away from that classic number nine's position, and he occupies that zone between the midfield and the forward line where it's not obvious he should be picking him up. And that creates different angles and creates space for people to run into.
Can a true nine be a false nine? I mean, is it just, you know, if a centre forward did that, centre forwards drop deep. What's Harry Kane at the moment? Is he a 9-9 or a false nine or a middle nine?
Well, I think he's a really interesting case in that he's got elements of both a traditional nine and a false nine. But I think that's quite an unusual range of characteristics to have. I mean, something like Teddy Sheringham probably could have done it and probably did do it at points in the 90s, but just didn't really pick it up. You think of somebody, I don't know, somebody like Nigel Clough was a centre forward who dropped off. But he always invariably did it with another centre forward ahead of him. So, you know, he's a centre forward dropping into the position of a number 10.
Right. But, like Beardsley might.
But they would always have somebody alongside them. So that's the difference, right. Is the idea of having space, having somebody, you're not having an orthodox centre forward ahead of you.
Barry, John Stones for England?
I think he should be in the squad, certainly. I'd be honest, on current form, I'd have him in ahead of Harry Maguire, but I can't see that happening unless Maguire was to get injured. It was nice to see him score, actually, and to bamboozle Wilson with another music analogy. He sort of bundled it home with his 7-inch, but I thought that would get a laugh.
Oh, come on, we're better than that, Barry.
No, we're really not.
Ever since we got accused of dumbing down, I'm trying to make this an intellectual podcast now, Barry.
That was very disappointing. I thought that would get peals of laughter. Anyway, I would. On current form, he certainly deserves to be in the conversation, if not the team. I suppose the only question is, how much of his resurgence is down to the player he's lining up alongside? Him and Ruben Diaz seem to have struck up a fantastic partnership. Would John Stones be as good alongside someone else? I don't know, but he certainly has turned it around, as we discussed on Monday.
Johnny, I think everyone agrees that Manchester United were okay in that. I mean, Solskjaer was obviously pretty downbeat afterwards. He said, look, we need to be better. But I did think they were okay. I mean, it doesn't really mean much in a semi-final, does it?
Yeah, I mean, the French cyclist, Raymond Poulidor, you know, he I think he finished runner-up in the Tour de France 5 times, and they called him the eternal second. And United are kind of turning into, you know, with all these defeats in you know, the last four, are turning into the eternal semi. It feels like, you know, something that's... I thought that might get a laugh as well, actually.
Better. That was better than Barry's, and it really worked after Barry's.
I was just thinking, I don't know whether I'm allowed to laugh or not. I did appreciate the gag.
And now I feel tremendous pressure. I've got to come up with a weak penis gag.
Got about 45 minutes to do it. Johnny.
No, I mean, like I said, I thought United were quite... I mean, they were quite solid. I thought that they did lack a little bit. They did lack something in attack. I think Solskjaer waited about 75 minutes to make a change, which I thought the way the game was going was quite surprising. And it was Cavani who came on. Bruno Fernandes, I think, looks... I don't know whether... I don't want to say Bruno Fernandes looks cooked, but I think he's just had a game too many, because what's going to happen? He'll go on another run of sort of, you know, 12 games scoring in a row. But and while he has been sort of pulling out decent numbers, I think that did look a little bit like a game too far for him. He could do with a little bit of a rest. I don't think the front three kind of cohered in the way that it needs to in order to pull off a counter-attacking win over City in a game like that. I thought they were pretty solid. I mean, I thought the midfield was fine. This is what we've been saying about United for quite a long time. Their good level is pretty good, but they can't possibly hope to touch the level that City reached last night, and that's kind of the long-term problem for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point about Fernandes is interesting, that, you know, United is so reliant on him that if he does have an off night... And yeah, I agree, it may be weariness. I think Fernandinho played really well as well. So whatever combination of those two factors it is. But when he's not at his best, I mean, what chance did United really have? There was the Fernandes shot from range in the first half where Stefan made the, you know, really good save. there was a couple of set plays, and then the last 15 minutes was essentially just trying to get penalties. And, you know, if anybody wanted to, if United were trying to sort of knock down the conspiracy theory they get too many penalties, playing the way they did that last 10, 15 minutes was not the way to do it. Just put the ball in the box, fall over and scream.
Well, we'll get on to how many penalties Manchester United get when we talk about Liverpool's defeat at Southampton. Before that, tributes have been paid to Colin Bell, one of Manchester City's greatest players, who's died at the age of 74 after a short illness. He spent 13 years at the club, has a stand named after him, dubbed the King of the Kippax after one of the stands at Main Road. He won 48 England caps between 68 and 75, would have had more but for injuries, and was the linchpin of the City team that won every domestic trophy in a three-year period between 1968 and 1970, followed by the European Cup Winners' Cup. Scored 142 goals in 481 games for City and assisted many more. There were some really nice tributes in the last couple of days. Simon Hattonstone, if you haven't read it, wrote a brilliant one in The Guardian. And all, from everything I read, Wilson, you know, and more important than how good you are as a footballer, he came across as just a really lovely bloke as well.
Yeah, I think very humble. Yeah, no airs and graces about him. But, yeah, really clever, technically good midfielder in an era when being a good technical midfielder wasn't easy to be. And yeah, you got the knee injury against United in the League Cup semi in 76, which City went on to win, but, you know, he wasn't there in the final. But, yeah, effectively ended his career age 29, which far too young to end his career and far too young to end his life.
I spoke to Joe Corrigan on the radio yesterday, who talked about his comeback game. It was Boxing Day 1977, so 2 years and 44 days after the injury. The ground was full. He came on as a substitute to the most sustained emotional roar you've ever heard at a football match. And he came on for Paul Power. And apparently in the dressing room afterwards, Paul Power said, I knew I was playing all right, but I didn't think I had that good a game. It's a lovely story. Mike Summerby said he was just the greatest footballer we've ever had. Kevin De Bruyne reminds me a lot of Colin in the way he plays, in the way he is as a person. Even though I knew he'd been poorly for a while, I wasn't expecting to lose him. It's a complete shock. Obviously, our thoughts go to his family and his friends. So Manchester City will play Spurs. Jose gets Spurs to their first final since 2015 when they lost to Chelsea. Sissoko and Son with the goals. It wasn't exciting, Johnny, but does that matter?
Bielsa and Mourinho have become like the two most ideological managers in the Premier League. That Tottenham have become almost wedded, stubbornly wedded to playing really quite unappealing football. And it does seem like an ideological choice. Anyway, it worked for them. You know, they got the early goal, which is what they want and what they're very good at. And I mean, and they didn't sit on it exactly. They didn't sit on it like they did against Crystal Palace, say, or Wolves. And they created a few more chances. But then, you know, Brentford did come back at them a little bit. We are giving them a lot of credit for a semi-final win at home over Brentford. And, you know, people are talking about Mourinho ending this trophy drought. I think Manchester City showed last night. It's a huge, huge hurdle for them to climb. And, you know, again, you know, as with United, whether Spurs have that top level to beat an on-song City side, you know, they'll go into it with a lot of optimism and confidence, I imagine. But if City turn up, you know, Spurs have a real, real job there.
I suppose it goes to a sort of existential question about what the point of football is, and lots of people will just yell trophies at you, and maybe Spurs fans would be happy to watch this for a couple of years and win some trophies and then go back to trying to win them in another way that doesn't work. I don't know, Barry. I watched it on an exercise bike as someone who wants Tottenham to win, and maybe it was against Brentford. If it had been against you know, a team in the Premier League, I'd have been more excited, but I felt flat about that victory.
Look, I you could pick any year in the last 10 and I would struggle to tell you who won the League Cup. I would probably
guess City.
Manchester City if you know, someone put a gun to my head. But winning is
what
is
a sad scenario. What a sad scenario that would be. What a strange action movie we've suddenly found ourselves in, where someone says, "Glenn Denning, who won the League Cup and who were the sponsors in 2013?"
To be
Three,
fair,
two, one.
Zoom quizzes have kind of lost their edge a bit recently.
Yeah, if it was the 2016-17 Cup, I'd know that they didn't have a sponsor, but I wouldn't know who won it.
Okay.
So that's how much it occupies me.
I'll shoot you in the knee then.
I can remember the admin, but not the winners. Winning it is better than not winning it. It's the kind of competition no one really pays much attention to until suddenly... Yeah, I can remember, I can't remember what year it was, but when Sunderland lost to Man City in the final, I think Sunderland cropped up in the semis, and I sort of went, oh, that's interesting, oh, great, you know, Sunderland are in the semi-final of the League Cup, I really hope they go on to win it.
But I think that's even more true of Tottenham this year, given the only two teams they've beaten to get to the final are Brentford and Stoke. You have a penalty shootout win against Chelsea, a bye against Leyton Orient... Or, you know, walk against Leyton Orient and then buys before that because they're in Europe. It's the least whelming path to a final ever.
When Millwall got to the final of the FA Cup in
2004,
that was quite underwhelming. I think they didn't beat a single Premier League team.
Beat Sunderland in the semi, though, didn't they?
And then got tonked by Chelsea in the final.
Manchester United.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Bang! That's it. Sorry, Barry.
Are we sure?
Yeah.
It's too late now. Do we want to talk about the VAR offside, Johnny Liu, and Ivan Toney's knee ahead of Moussa Sissoko's right foot?
I think it was a correct offside decision, correctly given. The knee is a football meddling part of the body, and so, you know... Well done, VAR.
Josh De Silva was sent off for a nasty, if unintentional, challenge on Pierre-Emile Hojbjerg at the end of the game. He tweeted, "Anyone that knows me knows it was never intentional. We'll learn from this," praying emoji, to which Hojbjerg replied, "Of course you didn't mean it. Don't worry, I'm a Viking. I'm fine. You owe me a new shin pad. Halo emoji. You have a great future ahead of you, Josh De Silva. Be strong and keep working hard. Best of luck to you and your team. Big hug. Pierre-Emile Hojbjerg." I mean, with all the hate and division in the world, I thought that was sort of quite beautiful, Barry.
Yeah, tell that to the monks at Lindisfarne, Max, who met a grisly end at the hands of Vikings like Pierre-Emile Hojbjerg.
Okay, I'll see what I can do. The final's on the 25th of April. Jose's won the competition 4 times, the same as Brian Clough and Sir Alex Ferguson. No manager's won it 5 times. Dele Alli on Tottenham might be going to PSG. It sounded like he wasn't. Now it sounds like he might be. Who knows? Meanwhile, Poch drew his first game as the PSG manager, 1-1 at St Etienne. And while we're on this tiny Euro roundup, Juve won in Milan. Inter lost to Sampdoria in Serie A. In Spain, Messi scored twice. Barcelona up to third. Great rumour that Barca, because they want to keep Messi, will just buy an MLS franchise just to keep him happy. So they'll keep him for a bit and then send him to the one that they've bought. And Atleti were knocked out of the Copa del Rey by third tier UE Cornea. And from the third tier to the human tiers of Ralf Hasenhüttl. I'm sorry. I mean, it wasn't a penis joke, but you know, it's pretty shit. We'll start with Southampton Liverpool in part 2. Welcome to part 2 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Southampton 1, Liverpool 0. Firstly, let's start with Southampton. A brilliant goal, Johnny, from Danny Ings. I just thought it was such a lovely finish.
Yeah, it was a beautiful finish. It was, you know, well worked free kick from Ward-Prowse, who obviously, I think when you get a free kick, when you're defending a free kick in that zone about 35, 40 yards out, you know, you are kind of prepping yourself with Ward-Prowse to curl one in lasciviously towards the back post. And I think, yeah, Liverpool were just blindsided, weren't they? And it's kind of uncharacteristic. It's rare that you see that happen. And Ings sort of peels off the wall, peels towards the near post. And it's still, you know, it's still a really tough finish. And Alexander-Arnold probably should do better. And it's one of those goals that probably has an XG of about, you know, 0.01. But it sets up the whole game. All of a sudden, Liverpool, who have this kind of iffy away record, are forced to chase it. and they get into all kinds of trouble in the first half as they kind of go off to this game that has already slipped away from them, and it takes them a full 45 minutes to kind of get their act together. So yeah, I mean it was a really important goal for setting the tone of the game, and yeah, Liverpool were really quite poor.
And in the second half, Southampton, Barry, defended sort of heroically, you know, Jack Stevens and Jan Bednarak just hurling themselves at the ball as it was flying in.
Yeah, it was a brilliant, a brilliant all-round performance for Southampton, particularly good defensive performance with the players you mentioned doing superbly. And the fact of the matter is Fraser Forster didn't really have to do much. I'm not sure did he have to make any sort of particularly good saves to keep Liverpool at bay, and that's, I suppose, a testament to the guys in front of him. Liverpool were kind of resorted to slinging crosses into the box, and Southampton were able to deal with them. You think, you know, would have been able to deal with them if they played till midnight.
Just quickly, I was at Southampton a month ago for the United game, and the press box, the makeshift COVID press box, is right behind where the Southampton substitutes are sitting. And I was sitting right behind Fraser Forster, and Alex McCarthy was pulling off like save after save after save. And I was kind of looking at his reaction, and all his teammates were sort of getting out of their seats going, you know, applauding. And Forster was just kind of dutifully, yeah, well done. Just like, yeah, all right, well done. But he's got his chance now, and fair play to him.
What did you make, Jonathan, of the tears of Ralf Hasenhüttl?
It's interesting a league win in January could mean so much, but I guess the style of football he wants to play is a style exemplified by Klopp and Liverpool, and to beat them at their own game. I think particularly that first half, they really rattled Liverpool. Teams don't press Liverpool like that, and Liverpool looked very, very uncomfortable with that, which I think is interesting because, you know, last year you just said that Liverpool preferred playing against teams who came out against them and left space behind them. But here they didn't deal with it, certainly the first half, they didn't deal with it well at all.
Since they beat Crystal Palace 7-0 and we all gave them the title, they've drawn with West Brom and Newcastle, now lost this game. Barry, what do you put it down to?
They were so imperious last season, they were never going to be able to keep that up. You know, at some point they are going to lose at home. It could be fatigue, I don't know. Or it may be the number of penalties Manchester United get compared to the paltry, risible amount they get. I don't know.
I mean, I suppose it makes a difference. If you've got Fabinho and Henderson playing centre-back, that is, you know, that's two central midfielders. I know Fabinho's proved that he can do it quite well, but, and also you miss Fabinho from midfield, and Thiago is a wonderful footballer but looked slightly off the pace. I know, like, do you, Johnny, I think 3 weeks ago we all thought Liverpool would definitely win the league. I think everyone now, because City are the best team this week, thinks City will, but we shouldn't write off Liverpool, should
yeah,
we?
Yeah, I mean, the weird thing was that about sort of 2 months before everyone thought that Liverpool were going to win the league by 10 points, everybody thought that, you know, they were losing 7-2 to Aston Villa, and everybody thought that, and they had an injury crisis, and, you know, everybody thought their title challenge was wrecked before it had even begun. What happened, I think, is that they had, you know, they had the depth and they still had the energy to cover for those injuries at the time, and, you know, that they brought in, you know, kids like Curtis Jones, and they covered for it, and they rallied, which is what Liverpool do. They kind of rally against adversity. That is, you know, the very nature of that club. I think they're paying for it now. I mean, they actually had quite a kind Christmas schedule. They had a bit of rest, but I think the cumulative effect of players having to play again and again and again and again has caught up with them a little bit. I mean, I went through some of the stats, and Andy Robertson hasn't had a proper rest since July. He hasn't been rested. He started he's played in every Champions League and Premier League game since July. I think Mane has played something like 12 games in 40 days. It shows. It shows in that the way that Liverpool need to play is, I think, more dependent on full fitness than it is for a lot of other teams. And so when you don't have, you know, when you're missing that extra yard, it just looks, you know, your drop off in quality is so much higher as a percentage than, you know, than it is with other teams, say. And the other thing is the, you know, the analytics bots talk about like goal efficiency. And last season, they won so many games by one goal and two goals. Statistically, it's unlikely to repeat. You know, you're unlikely to repeat that. They wasted seven goals on Crystal Palace. Last season, they'd have got at least 12, 15 points out of that. So, you know, I think maybe it's just regression to the mean as well.
You joke about that, but I really genuinely, if Cambridge win a game 4-1, I think that is a waste of two goals. I genuinely think we should not have scored them in that game. You know, and I try and move them across when I'm looking at results. Jurgen Klopp said, I hear now that Manchester United had more penalties in 2 years than I've had in 5.5 years. I have no idea if that's my fault or how that can happen. I just sort of feel Liverpool are so much better than Manchester United that they don't need to be rattled. Klopp doesn't need to be like that.
But I mean, these stats about penalties, they never put, there's never any context about them. The way that Manchester United play will get penalties. If you have players running quickly into the box, the chance of them getting clipped and going down is quite high. At the same time, I do think United look for penalties, which I think is not a good thing. And I think the penalty they got against Villa probably shouldn't have been one. That if two players, Pogba and I can't remember who the Villa defender was.
Douglas Luiz, was it, I think?
Yeah, it was. Douglas Luiz. If they're sort of just running alongside each other and their thighs sort of knock against each other, not a foul. Even if, you know, one of Pogba's legs is then knocked onto the other leg and he goes down as a result. Yeah, that just because there's contact doesn't mean it is a foul.
Tom says, Donald Trump didn't explicitly tell any of his followers to storm the Capitol. So does Barry think that, like Kieran Trippier, he's being unfairly singled out? Marcus says, does the pod want to revisit the Trippier thing in view of lump on if you want? The FA have published the exchange between Kieran Trippier and friends to demonstrate the reasoning behind their decision to give him a 10-week worldwide suspension for breaking betting rules. He was found guilty in December for 4 betting rule breaches, though his ban has been suspended pending an appeal, and he was fined £70,000. Barry, would you like to do a theatrical reading of Kieran Trippier and his friend Oliver Hawley? You be Kieran Trippier, you be the star, Barry, okay?
Okay.
I think you could...
It's not Chekhov, but it pays the rent.
And I'm Oliver Hawley, and this is in a WhatsApp conversation. How's it going, mate? Any developments today?
Yeah, all good, mate.
What is that? I don't know if I want to carry on with this after hearing Barry do that. It's all agreed, just waiting for them to come to an agreement with the fee.
Should be done tomorrow or defo Monday.
That's class, mate. Is Levy going to be hard work or not, do you reckon?
They need to sell, so it should go through straight away.
At least that should get you out of going to China.
Yeah, be quality, mate. More money what I'm on now. Don't want to be going to China.
More money than you're on now is class, because this is a real payday opportunity. And, mate, Spain is better to live in than Italy.
Yeah, be class, mate.
Oh, and now Matthew Brady enters the room. Which one of you two would like to play the role of Matthew Brady? Johnny Liu. Okay, playing the role of Matthew Brady. Here we go.
Shall I lump on you going there? Laughing emoji.
Can do, mate.
100% trips.
Yeah, mate. Don't blame me if something goes wrong. It shouldn't be, but just letting you know.
Of course not. Don't be daft, mate. I'm only messing.
Lump on if you want, mate.
I'm nervous now.
So there we are. Well, everybody. Really was. It was tremendous there. Wilson, your thought. As director, Wilson, I presume that was the role. What did you think of that?
Can we take it one more time from the top?
No. Anyway, these are pretty damning given the current rules, Barry. But you don't believe so. Is that fair?
I suppose they're pretty damning given the current rules, insofar as Kieran Trippier broke the rule and therefore probably deserves to be punished. He was, I think, nailed for giving insider information, which he clearly did in a conversation with his friends, but I still think the punishment was far exceeded the crime, and I still think it's ridiculous that he can't have a conversation with his mates about where he's going next in his career because some betting company has opened a market on what is ostensibly his own private business. I heard a rep from a betting company talking to you on the radio yesterday. He was saying that bookies don't make money out of these markets, that it's just a bit of fun. And I think that's a bit disingenuous because it's not fun. It's to get football fans who are obsessed with transfers onto their betting site to see the likelihood of where various players might be going next And once they're on the site, the bookies obviously hope they'll get involved and open an account and have a bet here and there on this and that. So it's not fun. It's not really fun for anyone. But if what he says is true and that it's just a bit of fun and they're not making money out of them, why have them in the first place?
Just don't know why these markets exist. The idea that a betting company could set up a market that stops me having the conversations I want to have with my mates is ludicrous.
It just shows the extent to which football is being held hostage by the betting industry, which, and frankly, like, who is the victim here? If a player places a bet on their team to lose a game, then that has an impact on the integrity of the football game, and a betting company should be obliged to report that. If a player wants to, you know, have a conversation with his mate and somebody wants to make some money on betting on a transfer, something which relies on inside information and has been, you know, a market that's been put up by the betting company, who loses apart from the betting company themselves? And yet, as soon as something like this crops up, the authorities will bend over backwards to make sure that the betting companies which provide such a huge slice of their revenue are not put out in any way. It kind of stinks, actually.
It's not the job of the FA to act as policemen for betting companies, but that's what they're doing. And there are far more important issues relating to the relationship between gambling and football, that, or the betting industry in football, that the FA should be devoting their attention to rather than trifling amounts of money. And people have been saying, oh, well, if Kieran Trippier was, you know, working on the stock exchange and did this, he'd be put in jail. Well, he's not working on the stock exchange, and the stock exchange and a football transfer have literally nothing in common. So it's a really egregious analogy.
On the subject of fines, the dying Jedi, Nuno Espirito Santo, has copped a £25,000 fine from the FA for openly criticising Lee Mason following Wolves' defeat at Burnley. Probably fair enough. He did say he didn't ever want to see him again. and that'll do for part two. Part three, Flo Lloyd Hughes will join us. We'll talk about Phil Neville possibly leaving the England job and going to Inter Miami, and footballers going to Dubai, and if we think this is a good idea in the current climate. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring in Flo Lloyd Hughes to do a bit of WSL and Phil Neville chat. Flo, you said you warned us that you'd be grumpy today. How grumpy are you?
On a scale of 1 to 10, maybe an 8.
Okay. Where do Wilson and Barry naturally sit?
On the grump scale?
Yeah.
I would say Barry wakes up at a 5 and then progresses towards 10 as the day goes on, and like peaks at 10 at like 11 p.m. when people on Twitter are really peaking, and he goes to bed and manages to drop down 5 points.
I was on an email exchange with Barry yesterday where he was annoyed that people considered him to be misanthropic.
I'm not misanthropic.
But he said it's a lazy cliche.
Not compared to me.
Barry, what's your defence?
I try to see the best in everyone. It's just a lot of people, there isn't any best.
No, I agree with that.
All right, let's do Phil Neville first, because there's a lot of COVID news that we'll sort of try and do in one go. So Phil Neville's been approached by Inter Miami about managing the team, which is owned by his mate. That would seemingly end the idea that he would coach Team GB at the Olympics when his contract runs out. Flo, what's the general feeling about Phil leaving? Didn't everybody want him to leave?
I think everyone wants him to leave. I think the frustration is that it's kind of typical of him to almost have the last word. So he will leave on his terms, despite most people not wanting him to take the Team GB job based on, you know, what he's done with England and a lot of the rhetoric he's had throughout his whole tenure there. But it became inevitable because of the situation with all the national FAs and it becoming too political if they were to appoint a head coach from Scotland or Wales or alternative. So it just became like the obvious choice. And he was talking as if he was getting the job. The job was meant to be announced in November. It's January and we still don't know who it is. And the expectation just before the end of last year was it's going to be Phil and it's going to be revealed in a matter of days. That never happened. And now these rumours are swirling. And it's not surprising because, you know, where in reality, where his ability is pretty low, but in his head, he thinks he's there. Whereas if he's, in my opinion, if he has achieved and failed in ways that he has with England, with some of the best players in the world at his disposal, I don't think he's going to have success with a lumpy, slow Higuain and a decent Blaise Matuidi and some other randoms in MLS. I don't. And I think, yes, he may take the job and I'm sure he wants the job. And I'd be intrigued to see what fans over there think about it, because I recently wrote a piece for a magazine on Inter Miami and their fans are very ambitious. They are passionate. A lot of them come from supporting South American clubs. So it's not the traditional MLS supporters. They are, you know, they take this thing very seriously. And I think he will be shocked at, I think, any expectation that he is going to have a lot of success and a lot of support there. Because I just foresee where this is going.
Can we just dwell for a second on the remarkable serendipity of Phil Neville's, you know, assuming this happens, his coaching career, caretaker of Salford City, Manchester United coaching staff, goes to Valencia, a very well-known European team in La Liga, England women's job, which I don't think he even applied for, and now into Miami, which is owned by. He must give some really great interviews. You know, he must. His CV must be unbelievable. You know, what a great guy, and good luck to him.
I interviewed him in 2004, and honestly, he went on for like an hour and a half. It's one of the worst transcription jobs I've ever had. So he gives good interviews in that he just doesn't shut up.
Some could say there's some hypocrisy in you saying that, Wilson.
I mean, there's some hypocrisy in you saying that, but nobody transcribes what I write.
I mean, Serena Wiegman, she worked her way up through, like, she went to, I think, Den Haag, and she's won stuff everywhere she's gone and kind of moved her way progressively up the ladder. It kind of speaks volumes about, you know, the people talk about coaching as a meritocracy. It kind of stinks.
Mark Horgan from the Second Captains, the producer, he's sort of renowned for these amusing sound beds he does for the podcast, and one of them is David Brent doing, you know, various soliloquies from The Office, and Phil Neville talking about his sort of philosophy for coaching the England women's team, and they just cut from one to the other, and they're practically indistinguishable, you know.
You have to learn as a manager. He could get better. He could be a great success. None of us know. I wish him the best of luck, personally. And this is nothing to do with the fact that I was on the radio yesterday questioning whether Paul Scholes could tackle, and then he messaged Jamie O'Hara I was doing the show with saying, I was listening, and now I don't want to upset anyone from the class of 92 ever again. I think they're all great. Meanwhile, probably more importantly, Arsenal have asked for their WSL game against Aston Villa on Saturday to be postponed after an unsanctioned trip to Dubai led to a coronavirus case at the club. Three Arsenal players went there over Christmas, despite London being under Tier 4 lockdown restrictions, which meant travel abroad was disallowed except for business reasons. One tested positive. When they returned, teammates are said to be angry with the three of them, who didn't inform the club before going. The club has reminded the players of their responsibilities. Oh, that's a nice sentence. But has since been satisfied that the trips were made for commercial reasons. On Monday, Man City said four of their players had tested positive for coronavirus after they also went to Dubai. Manchester City did know about the trip and permitted the players to travel, as Manchester was in Tier 3 at the time. Flo.
I mean, I think anyone that follows me on Twitter will know how I feel about this whole situation. It's funny and it's also extremely frustrating and disappointing and irritating. And, you know, the last week we've also seen lots of Premier League players break the rules, and I felt exactly the same way about how insulting it was to their staff, their fellow teammates who they're putting in danger, and also everyone in the football industry who has bent over backwards and outside of it to ensure that the sacred game of the nation can continue. And they're putting that all at risk, and I think it's extremely selfish. And I feel exactly the same way, because not only that, but on another level, when the WSL and Championship were curtailed in May, June time, the outrage from all of us about the fact that the season wasn't going to be finished, and you know, we all had a go at the FA, and the FA said, well, you know, the players told us that they didn't feel safe playing, so there's nothing we can do. Okay, fine, fair enough. The amount of money the FA has spent on testing, which is more testing than the EFL has ever had until this week, when now the 72 clubs are finally going to get regular testing. They've had the same amount of regular testing as the Premier League, pretty much. So that's a lot of money that a technically national governing body that's supposed to look after the health of the grassroots game is spending. Now, yes, I want them to spend it, but at the same time, I can understand why they have to think about justifying it, considering how much they've lost this year. They are spending this money to keep the game moving. You've got people like Gilly Flackerty, former England player, former Chelsea captain, now captain at West Ham, who has lost her whole entire business that she put her entire life savings from football into in Essex because of the pandemic. Her and her partner have lost all that money. You've got people like that who have been so impacted and are now need to play to finish their careers and try and earn what's left. And you're just insulting them entirely by going on some kind of gratuitous trip to Dubai and flaunting that you have the money to do that and you think that your holiday is exceptional and you must go and do this. I just think it's so rude, and it's also embarrassing for the club, seeing as, you know, the day after London, the South East went into tier four and basically lockdown, Arsenal played a game against Everton and their manager said, you know, there's no exception for athletes. We will be sticking to the rules. We have to set an example, blah, blah, blah. Some players, I guess secretly, still found the need to, I guess for business reasons in their eyes, go on a trip to Dubai. And I just think it's so out of touch with reality. And I think why, and I know Barry was part of this exchange on Twitter last night, that it's definitely an eye on a divide within women's football that was foreseen ages ago. But as obviously money in the game grows, and like we've seen with the Premier League, where every single player is earning a lot of money, there is such a divide in women's football of the have and the have-nots. And there is a selection of players who are earning a lot of money through England and through their clubs and through outside, you know, endorsements and sponsorships. And then a lot of players who are earning between 20 and 30 grand are in shared housing where there's rats everywhere and they're eating jam sandwiches and are struggling to get by. And this, what this has done is just exposed that divide so much and stirred up a lot of frustration and, I think, issues about that, where there's people are coming out of touch with what's going on. And the fact the Championship, you know, those people are trying to hold down part-time jobs as well as play, and others feel like it's necessary to go to Dubai. And, you know, there's lots of people who gave up a lot last year. You know, I know people that died of COVID. I'm sure lots of our listeners know people that have died of COVID. I know people who couldn't access mental health services that probably would have kept them alive. You know, we've got more cases of the pandemic now than ever before. I just don't get it. I just don't get it.
Do we think the Premier League players should get a ban for breaching COVID?
Well, probably. I think a ban and a whacking great fine, and a big, big fine, not one that's not going to particularly hurt them. Crystal Palace, I thought it was quite interesting, actually. Luka Milivojevic finally issued an apology for being pictured at a New Year's Eve party last night, just as it looked like America was going to, like, explode. I thought that was quite well timed. We'll sneak this out while everyone's attention is diverted towards Washington. He not only played for Palace the day after it was discovered he'd broken the rules, but he still retained the captaincy. And as somebody pointed out on a recent pod, or it was John Broome pointed out on Monday, you know, Roy Hodgson, exactly, his manager, is an old man who is very vulnerable. But
Roy Hodgson pretty much gave him a pass and excused his behaviour.
I mean, the clubs really should take action, but you can see why they don't want to hinder themselves. So it should be a Premier League or an FA thing. Football can only continue if these protocols are stuck to. And if they're not, there have to be consequences. Now, finding players is very difficult, I think. Because of PFA regulations, you only find people up to two weeks' wages. Yeah, but you can ban them. You can say this is the equivalent of a red card. You're out for three games, and these protocols have to have some kind of substance behind them. They have to be backed up.
Worth also noting, you know, look, Derby's entire first team squad are going to miss their third round FA Cup tie away at Chorley, so they're sending the under-23s because of a coronavirus outbreak. No suggestion that was, you know, people get coronavirus even if they don't flout the rules, but it does make you wonder how this season is all going to end. Anyway, Flo, thank you so much. You were grumpy, so it was, I think, necessarily so.
Thanks, guys.
Flo Lloyd Hughes there. Dan says, can we have some Copa Libertadores chat? It might be a bit out of his jurisdiction, but considering they were playing Boca last night, can you ask Jonathan Wilson why Santos manager Cuca looks like a maniacal Grand Theft Auto villain?
I mean, I guess that's genes, isn't it? That's why genes and a sort of styling preference. It was a terrible game, that. I tried to watch it live because it started.
Can you just remind us who's playing who and where we are at with it? Just obviously me and Barry are across it, but some of our listeners may not.
The semi-finals first legs have been the last two nights. So you had last night was Boca v Santos. It started at 10:15 UK time, and so I thought I'd try and watch as much as I could before I fell asleep. I got to half time. I couldn't last any longer. I tried to watch the remaining half this morning and I really struggled because it was a terrible game of football. It finished 0-0. As far as I could tell, the only notable thing that happened was a terrible, terrible dive by the Santos right winger Mourinho, which didn't result in a penalty, even though Nigel Iacocca, who I think is a very good co-commentator, he thought it was a penalty.
I thought you were going to say he was playing. I was like, wow. Even though there was contact from him, I was like, Iacocca, that's a surprise.
He must have watched an awful lot of Libertadores this season because his knowledge was phenomenal. I don't know if he watches it just because he likes it or whether he's done proper research. But anyway, he's good as a co-commentator. The previous night, River Plate had played Palmeiras. Palmeiras, I think, have probably been the best team in the competition this season. They're unbeaten in the competition this season. It was a bit of an odd game in that River was sort of on top and then there's a bad error by their keeper, Armani, who's been very good for them. But for some reason, came for a cross under no pressure from anybody other one of his own defenders and decided to go with his feet, knocked out to Honi, and Honi volleyed it straight back in. And that put Palmeiras 1-0 up, and River then lost the discipline. Luis Adriano scored on the break early in the second half. You might remember him, used to be a Shakhtar player, and also has a walk-on part in my Beyonce anecdote, which I know you enjoy. The third goal from Matias Vinha. So Jorge Carrascal was sent off for having a wild swipe just sort of lashed out. So even though River had 71% possession, they got beat 3-0. So it looks like Palmeiras are through with the second leg of Santos Boca still to come.
So I punted out for questions for today's pod, and it was probably the only tweet in about within 5 million tweets either side of each other that wasn't about what was happening in the United States. So all the questions were about what was happening in the United States. I learned a new word. Doom scrolling is when you just can't stop scrolling on social media. I'd never heard of doom scrolling before. Anyway, here are some questions which probably don't require answers, but you know, we wish all the best. We've got a big audience in America, and we obviously wish them all the best in what is a weird old time. Tim says, whose pursuit of a right winger was more futile? Manchester United's pursuit of Jadon Sancho or Capitol Building Security's pursuit of the Trump supporters? Paul, are these rioters just Bielsa cultists? Ryan, should the DC police have played five at the back instead? Ram says, should we have a 2-month transition of power before a new manager gets appointed? What kind of shenanigans can the outgoing manager do in the interim? James, which of the pod is most likely to incite a riot? You can answer that one. Who do you think that might be?
Barney.
Barney, okay. And finally, of course, the question we're all hoping for. Rich says, 2 pods without a Burnley match to talk about. How are you all coping? Well, we did. We coped just about. Look, thank you so much for your time. Much appreciated. Thank you, Johnny Lou.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Barry Glendinning.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.